From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in while Terry Gross is on vacation. On this edition of Fresh Air, we explore the place where the women's movement and the news intersect with Los Angeles Times editorial writer Kay Mills. She's written a history of women in American newspapers. Nearly a quarter of a century ago, writer Hubert Selby Jr. shocked readers with his novel Last Exit to Brooklyn. Now Selby's story of New York's down and out is being made into a movie. We talk with Hubert Selby. And we have reviews of the new album from the rock group Pere Ubu, and of Martin Scorsese's controversial new film, The Last Temptation of Christ. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The newspaper life, as depicted in plays like The Front Page and Even All the President's Men, is a workaday world of hard-drinking, wise-cracking reporters, most of them male. But those times may be changing, albeit slowly. My guest Kay Mills has written a new book that tells how women are moving into the newspaper business in ever greater numbers. Mills' book is titled A Place in the News, From the Women's Page to the Front Page. In it, she points out that though great progress has been made over the past 20 years, the career path for women in newspapers has been fraught with discrimination, insults, and hazing. Mills' anecdotal and thoughtful account was drawn from the experiences of the 150 reporters and editors she interviewed. Kay Mills began her career in journalism 20 years ago at United Press International, and she now writes editorials for the Los Angeles Times. Kay Mills took a leave of absence from her job at the Times to write A Place in the News because she couldn't find a book that told this story on the shelves.
First of all, I taught a course several years ago at the University of Southern California on women in the media, and I realized there was no book. I'd always wanted to write a book, and it seemed like two and two made four in that case. When you were teaching a course like this, all you had was magazine articles, and it seemed to me students believe things more when they're in books. So that was one reason. I'm sounding a little facetious, but actually I think my higher motive was that I thought young people, young men and young women going into the profession ought to know more about it, ought to know more about the lawsuits and the pioneers and that sort of thing. It's not like we want to sound like, you know, I walked 4 miles through the snow to school every day. But I thought they needed to know something about the profession. And I guess the other reason that I wrote the book was I was hoping it might change some things, that some people at the top might read it, might see the wisdom of what I'd written, and promote some more women into some of the top jobs.
You make an interesting point. You say that newspapers define what news is by the fact that it appears in the papers, and that you see women getting work in newspapers as a way of getting more women in newspapers.
Mm-hmm. It really is connected. I mean, I think women who are reporters are not necessarily any better reporters than men. I mean, we cover fires the same way. We cover prison breaks the same way. But I do think everybody hears different things. Blacks hear different things. Latinos hear different things. Asian Americans, Native Americans, women. So I think what happens is you know more about what one segment of the community is interested in, whether it's children, women's health problems or something. So with more women there, they finally realize they could speak up and say, hey, you know, politics isn't the only thing that's news. Or if it is, women in politics are part of that story, too.
How powerful an instrument of change do you see newspapers?
Oh, probably not as much as they used to be. I mean, certainly television has had such an enormous impact. But I think newspapers, certainly the serious ones, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, whatever, the serious ones still are the agenda that what's in the paper that day is what the radio and TV shows also show. So I think we definitely still help shape the agenda.
It's true. You can go through network newsrooms and see reporters tearing out stories from the New York Times and the Los Angeles
Times,
getting their story ideas for the evening news.
Yeah, it's the ripple effect. We do some of that. I mean, there's feedback. The ripple sometimes washes back into the newspaper newsroom. If TV's making a big deal out of something, then we start making a big deal. I mean, we all sort of work in the same pond, to continue that awful metaphor. But I think newspapers still, particularly the good ones, have a profound influence on what people think, particularly the decision makers. That's why I guess I think it's so important that women be part of the decision-making team at newspapers.
What attracted you to the newspaper business, and were there many women in it when you started?
There were not many women, no. I worked on my junior high school paper in Bethesda, Maryland. I worked on my high school paper. I worked on my college paper at Penn State. I was sort of single-minded. I guess maybe what attracted me was the chance to be nosy and get paid for it. The chance to write, that was really what it was. I liked to write. I wasn't into writing fiction or poetry. As one of the women that I interviewed said, she didn't fancy sitting in the attic wearing a cameo and being Emily Dickinson. She wanted to get out in the world, and I guess that's a bit of what attracted me. I had an uncle who was a copy editor for the Roanoke Times years ago, and he didn't have to go to work until 2:30 in the afternoon. I thought that sounded really neat.
What time do you have to be at work now?
Well, I go in very early to beat the traffic in Los Angeles, so I'm at work by about 7:30 or 7:45. I'm not a night person anymore, but that at the time when I was about 7 years old, it seemed really neat that he could sleep until 11 o'clock in the morning. I thought that was the greatest thing. And also, any time I was visiting there, if there was a fire, we could call up my uncle and find out where the fire was. Boy, that was, you know, we knew something before other people did. So I guess that was what planted the seed. Then when I started, it's interesting, you know, the first woman that I ever worked for was the editor of my college paper at Penn State. It's also the last woman I ever worked for. Interesting commentary on our times. But when I started, which was with United Press International in Chicago in 1964, I guess it was, there were several women there. There still were some barriers to break down. They didn't want to work the overnight from midnight to 8 because they said it wasn't safe. I pointed out to them that we went home at midnight, and that, you know, so why not come in at midnight and we can make more money? Well, that seemed to make sense. So UPI was actually pretty good about women. We have a joke there that it was an equal opportunity employer. It treated everyone poorly. when I went to work in Baltimore, I was only the second woman ever in the newsroom since World War II. And the first one, fortunately, had been good, so it was okay to hire me. So I have seen enormous changes in the business in that 20, 25 years.
You quote Pat Morrison of the Los Angeles Times telling a joke, saying that she became a journalist because she wanted to see men type.
Right. It's a great leveler, and I never really thought of it that way. You can always count on Pat for some good lines. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I talk about a place in the news, I tend to get sort of serious and talk about what women can contribute to the newspapers, the need for women to be at the top. But as I was thinking about it on the way in today, I realized there are a lot of funny stories in the book, too, you know. There are a lot of stories that I think people, men and women, would identify with. Dale Mezzacapa of the Philadelphia Inquirer took her little boy to the National Organization for Women convention a couple years ago. And she tells a very funny story about trying to finish up her work after the daycare part of the convention had ended and trying to write the story, trying to interview Ellie Smeal. The whole Now hierarchy was babysitting for Matthew while she was interviewing Ellie Smeal. And then she couldn't finish the story before she had a plane to catch, trying to file the story in the Atlanta airport with Matthew, whose diaper badly needed changing, wandering off. I mean, you know, they're just some moments that everybody would identify with in the book, or things that Molly Ivins of the Dallas Times Herald said. Molly is a very funny woman, and she told some very funny stories in the book, and I think it's not all heavy stuff, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
My guest is Kay Mills. She's an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and author of the new book, A Place in the News, From the Women's Pages to the Front Pages. Part of the difficulty of getting women from the women's pages to the front pages as correspondents, as reporters, has been the sort of the clubbiness of male reporters. And one of the most startling stories in your book is that of the National Press Club, which did not allow women until 1971. But one of the I was interested to see that Nikita Khrushchev had an important role in trying to bring about the end of discrimination at the National Press Club, that august body in Washington, D.C.
Yes, that story has surprised a lot of people because they tend to think of the press as sort of an egalitarian body. But the National Press Club did not vote to admit women until 1971. There was a big campaign that was mounted to try to change that. Helen Thomas, who's the senior White House correspondent now, was one of the principal movers in that. And the problem was that, I mean, you think, so what, a club, who cares? But the problem was that leading national and international figures came and spoke to the National Press Club if they spoke nowhere else. And if you couldn't cover that, if you weren't a member, you couldn't get in, you couldn't do your job. Now, granted, there were not as many women in the press corps then either. Press Club finally relented and let women sit in the balcony. But what that meant was that people like Helen Thomas were farther from the telephone, couldn't get a speech text if there was one, couldn't ask questions. So they were at a competitive disadvantage with, in Helen's case, with the Associated Press. So they went on this campaign to try to get foreign visitors not to speak at the press club. And one of the ones who said no, he wouldn't speak there unless the women could come, was Nikita Khrushchev, which, of course, raised great consternation at the State Department and among the male members of the press club. So they relented in that one case and let women in. And then slowly, gradually, they let women have tables on the main floor, then they let them ask questions, then finally they realized that they were in danger of becoming the men's press club if they didn't admit women, and they voted. There were, by that time, a number of men who thought this whole thing was silly and that women should be members, and they voted overwhelmingly to let women in. Why they had wanted to keep them out for so many years, the only thing I can figure is that they wanted their bar sacred so that they could get away from home and go sit and drink in peace. I don't know. It all seemed rather silly to me. I do remember one summer when I was working for UPI in Washington while I was in college. I had to sit in the balcony when covering an event, and it's a sobering experience.
16 years have passed since the National Press Club then has admitted
right,
women.
Right, exactly.
What
and
about...
They have merged with what used to be the Women's National Press Club. So there is now one press club, and there have been several women who have been presidents of the National Press Club, by the way.
What changes have you seen amongst women reporters since that time? Are women and men reporters able to work on the campaign trail as well together? Are women in newspaper management now in analogous positions to men? Has there been that much progress in 16 years?
There's been a lot of progress. There's never enough progress, you know. Certainly, this political campaign, you look at the front page of the New York Times, you look at the front page of the Los Angeles Times, you see women's bylines on the campaign trail. Still don't see too many women writing the election night lead, the convention lead, when Michael Dukakis or George Bush gets the nomination. The big boys still do the big stories. But that's changing. That's breaking down. There are a number of women. There are 8 women now who are editors of newspapers. Catherine Fanning at the Christian Science Monitor, Janet Chusmir at the Miami Herald. We have 2 in California, 1 at the Fresno Bee, 1 at the Riverside Press Enterprise, but that's 8 out of something on the order of 1,700 newspapers. So, there are more editors of smaller newspapers, but it's still something on the order of 12 or 13% of the senior editors at newspapers are women, where the workforce is about a third women. So that's a little out of sync yet.
How much of this is a function of age? I ask because a friend of mine is a reporter for a newspaper. She's in her, late 20s, and she finds that the people who are leaving newspaper buildings tend to be these sort of world-weary men in their 50s and 60s, and that she hopes that eventually, you know, as they move on into retirement, there'll be more openings for women, and that it's a matter of time in this regard. Is this a realistic assessment of what's going on in the newspaper business?
Oh, I think your friend's absolutely right. Certainly, the generation that's now in charge of newspapers is almost exclusively white male. As they retire, there are slowly some openings. There are a number of women in middle management now, trained and ready to move up. I think if time were the answer alone, though, we would have more women in top jobs. I mean, there have been some major legal actions. The New York Times was sued. The Associated Press was sued for sex discrimination. Both those cases were settled out of court, but they opened some doors for women. I think that what's still needed is more commitment at the top. If a publisher, if an editor really believes in advancing women, and I might add minorities, then I think more will happen faster. If we wait for time alone to change this and bring your friend into a management job, I'm afraid we're all going to be sitting around at the old feminist home before that happens. So it needs a nudge, is what I'm saying.
Well, the Washington Post had a publisher, Catherine Graham, the New York Post, publisher Dorothy Schiff. What was the policy at those papers when, as they were publishers, toward hiring women as both reporters and in management? Or did it make a difference?
Well, I think Dorothy Schiff made a difference. She put, I'm cite in a place in the news, the case of Judy Michelson, who was a reporter and actually a secretary for the editor. And Dorothy Schiff saw a couple of stories she'd done on sort of a tryout basis, I guess. And she helped make her a political reporter. So I think she made a difference. Certainly Helen Reed at the New York Herald Tribune years ago made sure Maggie Higgins went overseas, and Maggie Higgins went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage in Korea, and she brought Irina Van Doren in as the book editor and brought Dorothy Thompson in as one of the first syndicated political columnists. Excuse me.
Yeah, were these extraordinary moves on their part? Or it sounds like they
were
kind of rare.
They were, and I think you have to bear in mind that the women at the Washington Post filed an equal employment opportunity complaint while Catherine Graham was publisher. So while she was good in some cases, you know, it was still some of the guys that were running the national section and the foreign section and the metro section that were not doing as well by women as the women felt they could be.
My guest is journalist Kay Mills. She's just written a new history of women newspaper reporters titled A Place in the News. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Kay Mills. She's an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, and she's written a new book that looks at the recent rise of women going into the newspaper business. It's titled A Place in the News. Are there any places where women are at a disadvantage as reporters?
I think in some cases, some women may still be at a disadvantage as sports reporters. They've really had some of the last barriers to break down. It's the old locker room thing. And that has broken down in places where women are sports reporters. But as one of them said to me, every time in a smaller paper a new woman is assigned to the sports beat, she has to go through the same thing of some hazing in the locker room, some question as to whether she knows sports well enough. I mean, it's all rather silly because women have been sports fans for a long time. You look at a game, you go to a Dodger game, and you look around the stadium, there are a lot of women there, and they're yelling just as loud as the men. They know just as much, and they weren't dragged there by force. So I think that's one place where certainly they're still having to prove themselves. I'm not sure they're at a disadvantage. I think women can pretty much do as much as men. If they're at a disadvantage, it is sort of in the men's eyes, or sometimes we defeat ourselves a little bit. We're not sure we can do it. And you really do have to tell some of the young women not to let the cops bother you when, you know, they think you can't do the job or you're too young or something. Just work on through it, you know.
What about what's going on in locker rooms? athletes like to parade around nude. You talk about Reggie Jackson doing that a lot.
Right, yeah.
In part to intimidate the women coming in.
I think so. And I think that's changing as they get more and more used to it. And certainly in the sports where the players have been to college and had a little more sophistication, and that's a word that's a little strong to use, but I mean they've had a brush with classes, as one of the sports writers told me, and they're certainly better. The basketball players, generally speaking, don't seem to have any problem with women in the locker rooms, and even a lot of the football players. So that's changing, but each place there's a new woman. There's a certain amount of hazing of any new reporter on a beat. Police beat, they like to show you a dead body, you know. They just want to see if you can do it. Mm-hmm. And once mm-hmm. you work through it, Helene Elliott of Newsday told me just a very funny story of how she handles the players in the locker room. She was covering the New York Rangers hockey team, and one of the players' wives asked her, don't you look, you know? And she said, no, she said, I have a job to do. And she said, I can tell you that I know the color of every player's eyes. And so when she was in the locker room, the next time one of the players came up to her and closed his eyes and put his hands over the eyes of the two players on either side of him and said, okay, Helene, prove it. And I said, well, could you? She said, didn't I have to? So you deal with it in various different ways, but I think it is changing. I hope so.
And did she know the colors of those eyes?
She did. She did. She proved it. Believe me, she proved it.
Foreign correspondents have always been a way to the front page, and in many times women have turned down some of these assignments out of fear or dislike of spending a lot of time in South American hotels for months on end.
Mm-hmm.
But others have chosen to go. What is going on in a reporter's mind when she is making that kind of a choice? You've talked to, 150 reporters all told?
Right. And a number of them were foreign correspondents. I think, obviously, the single people, male or female, actually, find it easier to go. It is getting increasingly hard at newspapers to get some of the young men who are married to go because their wives work. It's interesting, the Washington Post, just to insert parenthetically, the Washington Post now has a married couple sharing the Tokyo assignment, and I think that's an interesting development that's worth watching and that more papers may consider. I think there are just some of us who are drawn to adventure, and there are some who are not, and certainly the interesting thing is that Latin America used to be the backwater that, if you felt you had to send a woman somewhere, you sent her to Latin America. And now it's a big story, and there are women all over the place who are experts in Nicaragua and El Salvador. And Abe Rosenthal, who's the former editor of the New York Times, told me when I was talking to him for my book, he said, you know, I went to Salvador to try to hire several correspondents. He said, I'm used to being in war zones. I've been to Beirut and the Congo and so forth. And whenever you arrive in one of these places, you go to the hotel and you find the correspondents, the swapping stories. And he said, in Salvador, a number of them were women. And he said, there were three or four of them that I would have hired if I could. And he did hire Shirley Christian, who now covers Buenos Aires, for the New York Times. So It's interesting that what used to be a backwater has now developed into a story, and women have benefited from it.
You took a leave of absence from your job at the Los Angeles Times to write this book, and you're fairly critical of the Los Angeles Times and their policy. Have you gone back to work at the Los Angeles Times now?
I have been back writing editorials since Labor Day of last year, so almost a year, yes.
So what was the reaction? Have you been able to bring about some change at the Times?
Well, not yet. A little frustrating, but I got a very nice note from the publisher of the paper, Tom Johnson, saying that he had looked over the book very carefully, thought it was important and well done, and that he knew that the Times needed to do better, and we would do better. I keep needling him about delivering, you know. But certainly the reaction among my colleagues is very favorable. They, in fact, think I perhaps should have been a little harsher on the paper. Generally speaking, we're waiting. We have a new editor, Shelby Coffey, and we're waiting to see what happens.
You work as an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times. Does this mean that your work appears for the most part without a byline?
That's right. Sometimes I feel very anonymous. I combat that fear of anonymity, if you will, by writing some profiles about half a dozen times a year with Westerners, particularly Californians, who have interesting ideas. Mm-hmm. So I get a byline occasionally because, after all, I think journalists have an ego or we wouldn't have gone into the business. So that's how I combat it. But, yes, for the most part, I write things that are the Los Angeles Times opinion, so I don't have a byline.
You quote Karen Elliott House of the Wall Street Journal as saying, "I think women may have become conservative with success. Mm-hmm. When you have nothing to lose, you're willing to risk more." Do you feel that you're at that point in the career that you've become conservative with your success as an editorial writer? What are you willing to risk?
Well, you know, I asked a colleague of that of mine that just the other day when I was thinking about needling somebody about something, and I said, it was sort of the flip side, am I in danger of sounding off too much? She said, you can't sound off too much. Don't be conservative. And so that does enter my mind. I don't think so. My general sense is that for writing this book, still being at the L.A. Times and criticizing the L.A. Times, I'm not sure that's terribly conservative. They've been very good about it, but I think I stepped on some toes. And if that's conservative, so be it.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about the history of women in newspapers.
Well, I appreciate the time very much. Thank you.
Kay Mill's new history on women in newspapers is titled A Place in the News, From the Women's Pages to the Front Page. It's published by Dodd Mead. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor Dean Stockwell. He was a child star in the 40s, dropped out of acting in the 70s, and has recently made a comeback. You may remember him as the deranged drug dealer with the white makeup who lip-synced Roy Orbison's In Dreams in the film Blue Velvet. Stockwell is now in Jonathan Demme's new film, Married to the Mob. I hope you can join us.
I close my eyes, then I drift away into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer, like dreamers do. Then I fall asleep to dream my dreams of you. In dreams I walk with you. In dreams I talk to you. In dreams you're mine. All of the time we're together.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Hubert Selby Jr. lived a life all too close to that of the characters in his novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn. That was 25 years ago when Last Exit's portrayals of prostitutes, junkies, and bums shocked the literary establishment. Now Last Exit's being made into a movie by a German crew, and his other writing is being reissued. Coming up, Hubert Selby tells how he's coping with his renewed success. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Tenement Year, the new album from the Cleveland-based band, Per Ubu. It's a type of music the band describes as avant-garage. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Last Temptation of Christ, the movie event of the year, before it's opened. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Agriculture Department today issued a report confirming the fears of most analysts about the effect of the drought on the nation's food production. The department's monthly crop report estimates a 37% decline in the corn harvest compared to last year and a 23% drop in soybeans. Rising grain and soybean prices have pushed up food costs and contributed to a modest acceleration in overall inflation. President Reagan today signed the nation's largest ever drought relief bill. Standing before several farmers invited to the Rose Garden signing ceremony, Mr. Reagan said the $3.9 billion aid package expresses a distinctly American tradition of lending a helping hand when misfortune strikes. The president praised Democratic and Republican congressional leaders for putting aside partisan differences to speed action on the bill. Most big banks raised their prime lending rates a half point to 10% today. Chase Manhattan led the way, followed by Chemical Bank and Continental Illinois. West Coast banks, Wells Fargo, Security Pacific National, and others followed suit. The prime is now at its highest level in 3 years. The increase follows a decision by the Federal Reserve Board on Tuesday to hike the discount rate by 0.5%. Economist Jason Benderly says private institutions may have taken stronger measures if the Fed had not acted when it did.
We might have seen long-term interest rates rising by even more if the Fed had failed to take this action. So there's a trade-off involved between the behavior of the financial markets in the absence of what the markets think is a justified tightening versus the adverse effect of the tightening itself.
This is the third time this year that banks have raised the prime, which is used in setting a range of fixed and adjustable rate corporate and consumer loans. Richard Thornburg's nomination to be the new Attorney General sailed through the Senate this evening. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
After less than a half hour of debate, the Senate this evening confirmed Thornburg's nomination. The vote was 85 for confirmation, none against. Thornburg will take office immediately. As for Attorney General Edwin Meese, he will mark his departure tomorrow with a news conference, but Meese's words may not be the last about his controversial tenure in office. The Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, the department's internal watchdog agency, is currently completing an investigation of Meese's ethics. According to knowledgeable sources, the Office of Professional Responsibility has already compiled a draft report critical of Meese's conduct and has asked Meese's lawyers for a response. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The State Department today warned Americans to avoid traveling to Burma because of ongoing violent protests. Those anti-government demonstrations continue today despite tough talk from Burma's socialist authorities. Christopher Gunness is monitoring the unrest.
Prime Minister Thun Thin said the present unrest is crippling the country and having a damaging effect on the economy. He said that the price of basic foods had increased as a result of shortages caused by the disturbances, and that the government's recently announced economic reforms would be impossible to implement if the unrest continued. Defense Minister Sol Mong also appealed for calm. He said that the army was doing its duty in trying to contain violence and that it would continue to do so. These statements come after a day of further protests in Rangoon, which according to official sources has left 15 people dead and over 80 wounded. According to eyewitnesses, these figures are extremely conservative. Sporadic shooting is reported throughout the day in the suburbs of the capital. Tonight, Rangoon is quiet but tense. There is deep disappointment over the Prime Minister's speech. Reports that he was to address the nation fueled expectations of radical changes. In the event, these were not forthcoming, and there are fears that, for the time being, unrest will continue.
The BBC's Christopher Gunness. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 5 points. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Pere Ubu started out as a garage band, and their music still sounds as if a car and a couple of Harleys are revving up nearby. They've just released a reunion album, music they now call Avant Garage. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
How appropriate that the best American band to imitate the sound of clanging, buzzing machinery should have come from Cleveland, that ultimate Midwest industrial outpost. When Pere Ubu began recording in 1975, British punk rockers like the Sex Pistols and the Clash hadn't been heard yet. But sitting out in the middle of our country, Pere Ubu predicted everything that was to come. The band's music was a cacophony that was alternately delirious and melancholy. Pere Ubu made sure that the words to its songs were buried beneath a squall of guitars and synthesizers, so there was no way to tell whether the band's lyrics were voicing the same social and political frustrations that the punk bands did. But after all, you wouldn't really expect coherency from a group that named itself after the most famous piece of literature to emerge from the Dadaist movement, Alfred Jarry's gloriously incoherent play, Pere Ubu. The Tenement Year is Pere Ubu's first new recording in 6 years, and in its own assiduously eccentric way, it follows the current pattern for such would-be comebacks. In the sense that this album is a much more accessible, tuneful record than anything the band has previously made, it's comparable to the recent work of pop acts as various as Patti Smith or John Fogerty or Brian Wilson. Although, as you've already heard, this is not mainstream rock music, it submits to a pop tendency, which is to repeat in a simpler, more direct form, the style that first brought the musicians' attention. In this, Pere Ubu is just following a pervasive trend of the 80s. Even if you've never heard Pere Ubu before, you can tell from the excerpts I've played that the band's signature sound is the voice of David Thomas. That voice is a pretty amazing instrument. Thomas most often sings in a high-pitched warble. He enunciates like a man caught mumbling in a dream. He sounds preoccupied by something the garbled lyrics never make clear. Thomas uses a standard rock singer strategy, repeating key words for emotional emphasis, but he uses it to achieve effects that most rock singers never try for, to convey the sound of distraction, confusion, or pure bliss. What makes Père Ubu's music compelling as pop art is that it isn't the random chaos it might seem on a first listen. Instead, it's music that imitates randomness while inserting recurring riffs and choruses into its carefully conceived messiness. What I like most is the feeling of high spirits this cluttered music gives off. Where other bands use jumbled noise to express their tedious despair over the state of the world, David Thomas and Père Ubu convey a hard-edged but poetic lyricism that is unique in popular music. On no song is this more clear than on the album's lovely, funny, stirring finale, We Have the Technology.
Oh, I wish we could take this moment and freeze it, to come back again and again and again, to pull it to the light and turn it in our hands and study all the angles to find out.
Père Ubu's latest album is The Tenement Year. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Twenty-four years ago, Hubert Selby Jr. shocked the genteel literary world with the raw language and violent lives of the prostitutes, pimps, hoods, and factory workers that people his book, Last Exit to Brooklyn. Today, Selby's theme of alienation is attracting new readers, punks, the disenfranchised. A German production company is now making the book into a movie, and Grove Press issues a new edition of Last Exit next month. Selby's own life mirrors some of the experiences of the people he writes about. After joining the Merchant Marines as a teenager, Selby almost died of tuberculosis. He lost 10 ribs and a lung. And Last Exit to Brooklyn, which sold 750,000 copies, provided Selby enough money to drink and shoot heroin until he nearly killed himself. Selby never read a novel till he was in his 20s, but inspired by the cadence of Brooklyn street language and the music of Beethoven, he spent 6 years writing Last Exit to Brooklyn in the evenings after his day job.
When I first started writing, I kind of meditated a few days, and it seemed to me that I had to write about something I knew, and it seemed that that's what I knew the best. I knew violence, I knew alienation, loneliness, I knew that sort of thing best, and that just happened, you know.
And you were writing about the fringe life of Brooklyn, of New York, at a time when the fringe was hardly glorified at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think I glorified it. I don't know fringe. I never thought of it in those terms either. people are people, I think. They didn't feel like they were fringe in their world, and, you know, maybe we feel like we're a fringe in their world. But they were an integral part of their world, so I just don't think of them as fringe.
What was it that gave you a sense of worth living for? I mean, you've had a pretty rough
ride.
I died
a lot. I think that's... you know, I don't really know. I'll tell you the truth. I don't know. There's something inherent, I guess, in all of us. There's some ineffable spirit that we either reach to or we don't. And for some reason, the very things that created so much pain in my life, my defiance, my tenacity, my refusal to give up, caused me a lot of pain. But at the same time, they made it possible for me to survive and to prevail.
So you see yourself more on the side of determination rather than of quiet desperation.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been quiet desperation in my life. A lot of desperation, but unfortunately for the people around me, it hasn't been too quiet. As I say, unfortunately, I've inflicted a lot of pain on people, my, you know, family, close, intimate friends, because I just don't know how to stay too silent.
Could you describe a bit of 58th and 2nd in Brooklyn, this area in which Last Exit in Brooklyn was set, and that you were living at the time as you were writing?
No, I wasn't living there. I never lived in that area. Most of my life, I've lived in Bay Ridge, as when I lived with my parents. But I used to hang out down there for a short time, maybe 6 months. It was a kind of desolate area, similar to what it is now. And at that time, the Brooklyn Army base was active. It was just after World War II and the beginning of the Korean War, or just before the Korean War, I think, when I was hanging out down there. And at the same time, it was a family residential area in some parts. And we would just kind of hang out at this all-night diner, and when the sun came up, we went home, and when the sun went down, we came out. Yeah. And it was just kind of a boring kind of existence. Nothing to do, no place to go, no dreams, you know, no visions, and just kind of making it, you know, one day at a time.
The characters in Last Exit seem to try to relieve that boredom with violence, almost a random violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that seems to be a predominant factor in as far as the human race is concerned. See, I believe that the book is an absolute microcosm, and I don't see any difference in the world of Last Exit than the rest of the world.
Do you think that's why people reacted so much against it and had it banned in Britain and were so repelled by it when it first came
Absolutely.
Out?
Absolutely. I think people spend a lifetime defending against the truth and defending the lies that they choose to believe. See, there's only two human emotions we can experience, love or fear. So we're either coming from one or the other. Now, love, of course, doesn't need to defend against anything. Love only knows unity and the essence of life. And fear must defend itself by attacking. And it doesn't make any difference if it's Vinny beating up a drunken doggy or Jerry Falwell burning books. It's the same thing.
You've also written other books, including Requiem for a Dream and The Room. Would you like other people to know you for these books as well? Do you find that you ever get frustrated by being just so closely associated with one book title?
Yeah, I think that's probably an accurate statement. A lot of people ask me, what have you done since then? You know, that kind of thing. In Europe, the people are very familiar with all my work. In this country, it's a different situation.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not certain. I think, for instance, Last Exit was accepted by a lot of people who don't accept the other books because they could feel superior to the people in Last Exit. They didn't feel threatened by Last Exit. But I think some of the other books perhaps do threaten them. For instance, Harry White in The Demon is not from the lower class society. He's not from the streets. He's a very successful corporate executive, and people don't want to see that it's possible that the same thing that exists in Harry White exists in them. And, of course, it's true. There's a child molester and a mass murderer in all of us.
A German production team is now making a movie of Last Exit to Brooklyn. You know, in many ways, in order to make a good movie out of a book, you often have to make a travesty of the book in order to get it to translate to the film. Are you worried about that?
I don't think you have to make a travesty. You have to make changes. For instance, if you put Last Exit on the screen just as is, who could possibly sit through it? I mean, it would be unbearable. So there have to be some changes, but the essence of the book, the darkness and the pain of the book are part of the film, the basic part of the film.
I'd like to read a section, if I could, something that we can say on the radio, and ask you a bit about it. This is from the strike section, and this is the story of Harry, who is working in a union. He feels very proud of his role as being the shop steward, and he's assigned to kind of a nominal task during a strike, and at the same time he also comes to discover that he's a homosexual and wants to leave his life, and then ends up getting beaten up and...
Actually, sort of crucified on an outdoor advertising sign.
I want to find a scene here that I noticed earlier. Now there was something tangible to strike at, and the police, who had been standing, bored for months as the men walked up and down, finally found the outlet they, too, had been waiting for. And soon the line became absorbed by the mass, and two and three went down to their knees, and then others, too, strikers and cops, and a sign swooped through the air and thudded against a head, and a white-gloved hand went up, and then a club thudded, and hands, clubs, signs, rocks, bottles were lifted and thrown, as if governed by a runaway eccentric rod, and the mass spread out. And so on it goes.
It sure does, doesn't it? Sounds great.
That's only part of one sentence, too.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember writing that? Were you writing that in a burst of energy? Did you just sit down and write that in one shot?
Oh, I can't remember specifically about that. That was the last part of the book I wrote, and by that time I had attained a certain facility in writing, and it's quite possible that I did, but most of the time those sentences would come like one word an hour or one word a day. It literally was, you know, struck from stone. I had a very difficult time learning how to do exactly what I felt I had to do. And I know one of the great things, compliments I received from many people, is that they all have the impression that I just sat down and wrote this thing the way Kerouac said you should write. You know, I believe it was Yeats that said a poem should sound as if it took 5 minutes to write. And that's one of the things I struggle to do.
Well, Hubert Selby, I want to thank you very much for being a guest here on Fresh Air.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hubert Selby, Jr. is the author of Last Exit to Brooklyn. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up later from National Public Radio. Co-host Alex Chadwick is with me on the line in Washington. Good afternoon.
Hello, Sedge. We're going to be talking this afternoon with a journalist who's just emerged from Burma. You know, there's quite a lot of trouble going on there in that Asian country, disruption, demonstrations. It's difficult to get news out of there because few Western journalists are allowed in. One who was in has just been thrown out. We've managed to talk to him by phone to find out the latest from that country. There's also a kind of boomlet among Republicans for the vice presidential nomination of Colin Powell, the black national security advisor. And we'll have a portrait of the dissident Soviet historian Roy Medvedev.
And thank you, Alex, for this report. All these stories coming up on All Things Considered later today on National Public Radio. Martin Scorsese's new film, The Last Temptation of Christ, is opening in several cities this weekend, but it's already made the front page nationwide. Some call it sacrilegious. Others defend the director's artistic freedom. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
The brouhaha over The Last Temptation of Christ calls to mind a saying I discovered in an ancient Chinese text. He who pickets sells many tickets. If it weren't for the controversy, Last Temptation would doubtless wither at the box office. Despite the movie's very real power and its often striking intelligence, its first half could drive even diehard Martin Scorsese fans out to the lobby for some sacramental popcorn. Besides, religious movies never sell well. And make no mistake about it, this is a religious movie, the work of a devout believer, which is not to say a believer in every word of the Gospels. Scorsese has imagined a Jesus as torn and solitary as, well, as a Scorsese character. A Messiah virtually plagued by God, gnawed at by the demanding voice within him. Judas is recast as a hero. Jesus hands him the unsavory task of betraying him so that the Savior may fulfill his destiny and die on the cross. And then there's the famous Last Temptation, a sort of It's a Wonderful Life in reverse. In the second before Jesus' death, he's offered a prolonged vision of what would happen if he came down from the cross and took up life as a man. That's the kind of innovation those publicity-hungry fundamentalists are raging over. But what audiences may find harder to take is the way Scorsese's characters talk. In Last Temptation, Jews from Galilee often sound like Jews from Brooklyn. And film buffs may find themselves suppressing giggles when they spot cinema hipsters like Harry Dean Stanton as St. Paul, Harvey Keitel as Judas, or David Bowie as that thin white duke Pontius Pilate. The script also pares away the florid beauties of the New Testament and the florid babblings of the Nikos Kazantzakis novel as well. And though you may not at this late date want to watch a Jesus drowning in these and thous, great religious teachings have always derived power and complexity from their poetry. And one can't help feeling let down when Jesus, who's played too tentatively by Willem Dafoe, launches a lackluster Sermon on the Mount with the words, I'm sorry, but the easiest way to make myself clear is to tell you a story. All that aside, though, the movie has a curious kind of power. Scorsese has accomplished something new. He has recast the story of Jesus in American movie terms, with the emotional pull and sense of landscape that great American movies have always provided. He has stripped away his usual luscious crane shots and camera pirouettes, and what's left is the spectacle of sun-beaten men against wide-open spaces. Gradually, Last Temptation takes on the juggernaut velocity of a classic Western, the thrill of watching the loner Jesus round up his gang and head for Jerusalem owes as much to our memories of Jesse James and the Wild Bunch as it does to our Sunday school lessons. When Jesus approaches Golgotha to be crucified, we're watching a showdown scene. Only the adversary isn't some ornery cayuse, it's Jesus' humanity, whatever remains of his wish to live and avoid the sacrifice that will, if you believe Christian teaching, save us all. Watching Last Temptation's final hour, you get the most extraordinary sensation. As our hero is offered the choice of coming down off the cross to live a tranquil human life, we find ourselves tacitly urging him to stay and suffer. Don't do it, the audience wants to scream. Die for our sins. The Last Temptation of Christ evangelizes through the back door, using our movie-trained emotions to stir up our spiritual ones. At its best, it makes us believers, however temporarily, by convincing us that we are indeed watching the greatest story ever told.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, chaos. It's the name given to a new theory of science that unites phenomena as diverse as climatic change, the rhythm of the heart, and why no two snowflakes are alike. Chaos is also the title of a best-selling book. On the next Fresh Air, we'll meet its author, James Glick, who says scientists try so hard to explain the natural order that they miss its simplicity. Also, commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews Writing Red, an anthology of women's political writing on the labor strikes and radical politics of the Depression. And rhythm guitarist and singer Marty Gross will perform two songs for us. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris, stand by. Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.